lenses.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In earlier times, if you wanted to know something about science, history, or people, you could walk over to the bookshelf and pull out an encyclopedia. Sometimes they would have pictures so you could see the words that so you could see what the words were describing. In this digital age, encyclopedias have gone the way of buggy whips, replaced by the internet. Information about everything you want to know can be found there, as can pictures, even video. So if encyclopedias have disappeared, why do we still need museums? These repositories of artifacts behind glass cases cost a lot of money to run a museum, to mount exhibits, to promote those exhibits, and in most cases, it costs money for viewers to get into those museums. The internet, for the most part, is free. Is it time to rethink the existence of museums? Now, museum operators will acknowledge the question, but not its legitimacy, and in fact have carefully examined their mission in this digital age. So how are they deciding what exhibits make sense? What do museums have to do to remain relevant? How do they keep people coming through their doors? We've invited some area museum directors to talk about that this hour. Christopher Lawing is Vice President of Programming and Research at the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Emily Zimmern is President and CEO of the Levine Museum of the New South. Good morning to you
again. Good morning.
And Kay Penninger is Executive Director of the Charlotte Museum of History. Nice to see you again as well.
Good morning.
They are all in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Terry Davis, President of the American Association for State and Local History, the service organization for history museums nationwide. Terry, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
I know it was an insulting question. The whole idea of this show is probably insulting to all of you gathered around this table and on the phone. But is the question of the relevancy of brick and mortar museums and the exhibits that they contain a topic that you in the business confront?
Absolutely, but I would challenge your basic assumption that museums are not looking at their business models. Recently, I heard Wayne...
Well, I didn't say that. I said you are.
We are. Absolutely,
oh, yeah.
We are. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I said
we
you are.
Absolutely are, but like all institutions in society in a time of profound economic, social, and demographic change, and I think museums are coming up with really wonderfully relevant new answers to that question, both in becoming more virtual, digitizing collections. Actually, 40% of all visits to, quote, museums are virtual by going on websites and looking at information that is put on the web. But on the other hand, I think that there is a real power in the authentic, in the real. In fact, there's much research that says in this time of digital overload, people are looking for a place to retreat to, as if you will, disconnect to reconnect.
Because I know that some museums, when you talk about digitizing, like the Museum of Modern Art in New York has put some of their collection online. They've even created an app for it for the iPad where you can hit the app and you can see some of their collection. That's a, you know, one-dimensional kind of thing. But now I'm told some museums are they have digitized three-dimensional objects. And if you have a 3D printer, you can print out miniature versions of those objects. Is that where we're headed?
I think there are going to be many routes.
I think technology is a tool and an option, and like everything else, it has its role and its place. I agree with Emily that nothing can ever take the place of the authentic experience of coming out and walking the Hezekiah Alexander home site and really getting a feel for how they would have lived, what the house looks like as opposed to what maybe the size and scope of it, or seeing a painting in real life versus a picture of a two-dimensional
picture.
Yeah,
it seems to me that the art museums have a better time of this because you can see a digital version of one of the Andy Warhols, for instance, hanging in the Beckler Museum. But you don't really get a feel for it until you see it in its original form, its original size, the real colors, not what the digital screen is producing, and the essence of it hanging on a wall. You don't get the feel for it till you're there.
Right. I mean, there's something about an authentic experience when people come to a museum. And you're exactly right. When you walk up to a piece, you can see the brushstroke. You can see the light play in the shadow. You can really get a sense of the scale. That's something that you really can't capture when you see it on a screen. Mm-hmm. You're missing the materials that the artists use to create the object.
And
you get a different emotional reaction uh-huh. in person than you do from looking at it on a screen or a page.
I recall, Mike, several years ago, a new board member, walked into the museum. And
the Levine
Museum, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And the current board chair and I were walking her through an exhibition, and she became silent and walked across the room, and she was really studying what she was looking at. And then she turned and she said, "I have read about those my entire life, and I have never seen them. And they were the real white and colored signs from old Charlotte City Hall." That's the power of the real and the authentic.
Mm-hmm. Terry Davis, you're at a disadvantage because you're not gathered around this table. I'm not even sure where you are this morning, but you're on the phone someplace.
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay, and you deal with state and local history across the country, and you help museums in that effort. It's one thing to see Mount Vernon in a photograph. It is another thing to walk through the house and through the grounds at Mount Vernon, because you really do, this is my opinion now, you really do get a feeling that you can't describe, because you're actually there. You're walking in George Washington's footsteps. More importantly today, you're walking in the footsteps of the people who made that house possible. And we're talking about the slaves, because they made that house possible, and you get to see how they look. Now, that's what's going through my mind.
Right.
Is that what most people experience when they go to a history museum, when they experience a historic place firsthand, or is that just me because I'm prone to think that way?
No, I think it's you and a lot of other people. Museums are educational institutions at their very core, and although there are many I know that would argue that looking up an artifact on the Internet is educational, it's very hard to learn much about that artifact or the context or what was happening in the world or what it was like to be a slave or any of those things without having a personal experience. And what you just described is a personal experience. And I think that's what people want out of museums, is a personal experience. The whole notion of comparing museums to encyclopedias, I think, is just wrong.
Thank you.
Encyclopedias are didactic, and they're just one-dimensional. I also think that this notion of being able to print out 3D artifacts is something that the largest of the large museums will do, but we're very far away from most museums in the country doing that. History museums make up by far the largest number of museums there are in the country, and then the largest percent of history museums are small and medium-sized museums around the country, not as large as Mount Vernon or Colonial Williamsburg or the Henry Ford. So the diversity and the size and scope of the museum really has a lot to do with the way that they present their programs and what they're capable of doing. But the personal experience is very, very important. I don't know as much about the training and educational programs in art museums as I do history museums, of course. But I know that, according to the American Alliance of Museums, that over 55 million school children visit visit museums each year, and 850 million visitors in total, which total more than all sporting events, major league sporting events combined, baseball, football, hockey, and basketball. So it's still very popular to visit museums for lots of different reasons. Statistically, people taking children, grandparents taking children, fathers on the weekend, single fathers especially, and those types of things, are allowed to connect personally with their children at these types of experiences.
Has the question of the need to be relevant, and obviously the need to be relevant is the need to bring people in. That's how you bring people in. It's something that touches them or they think will touch them before they get there, and that's why they come. Has that increased, the need for that increased, the concern for that increased in as a result of the recession?
Absolutely.
Because funding has decreased.
I think that every public institution has to prove its relevance always to secure support. And I think one thing that museums broadly are doing are creating new pathways to public value, that museums are doing much more than they did in the past, particularly in the history area, of using history as a catalyst for civic engagement and dialogue and bringing people together to talk about issues that matter to them and helping them understand how the historical background directly relates to the present and our choices for the future. And
I think art museums are moving more towards more active engagement for their patrons versus a passive engagement. And with so many school children or young children being brought to the museums by their institutions or by their families, we're building the next generation of art lovers, history lovers.
What do you mean by passive versus active?
Well, I can remember when I was younger going to museums with my family and didn't really have a lot of interaction with the artwork because I would just walk around the galleries with my parents, not have any sort of materials to take with me, not be exposed to a docent, read any information on the wall. And I was just very passively engaged in what I was seeing. And there's been a trend over the past several years to really make the visitorship something very personal. And people come to museums, or history sites, history museums, for a lot of different reasons. And Emily talked about the one about respite and renewal. And also people come to be educated. People come to be facilitators. People come for social aspects. And it's the museum's job to actively engage these people when they walk in the door, or they tend to not be repeat visitors. Mm. You have to show them something and teach them something and instill something in them that gives them that much more curiosity to come
back.
So how
would give me an example. As a kid, we went on field trips. I grew up in the D.C. area, so we went on field trips to the National Gallery all the time, into the Smithsonian all the time. And I remember going to the National Gallery and being completely disinterested in all of the art. And now I love art, but those tours to the gallery were incredibly boring.
They can be.
For me. So what have you done to make them not so?
Well, let me just back up and say, yes, when you go to the National Gallery, or in your case, or other museums, you can become very easily visually cluttered by looking mm-hmm. at all the different art. And some programs of the past were more lecture-based that would talk directly to the students or to a group of people, and there was not a lot of interactive dialogue. A lot of that has changed. The Beckler Museum has taken on more of a visitor-centered, participatory museum approach, where we have not only regular docents that will interact with the viewers and the patrons, but we also have gallerists who are positioned in the gallery. They walk around with their iPads. They meet the customer where they are, ask them questions. The patron asks questions back. We look at
so it's
other
two-way.
Images.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely two-way. It's definitely a dialogue.
Two-way and some technology thrown in. I know that you're trying to get into this conversation, Kay, and I'm going to let you do that, but we have to take a break and we'll come back because I have several questions about the Charlotte History Museum as well. We keep throwing around these terms, history and other museums. It seems to me that all museums are history museums because nothing in there very rarely is new. Otherwise, it'd be hanging in your home if it's a piece of art. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Irish tenors Finbar Wright, Anthony Kearns, and Ronan Tynan with their Irish Holiday Celebration Tour in Dock Theatre on November 30th. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org and UNC Healthcare's Center for Transplant Care, providing lung transplants and treatment of respiratory diseases. More information at unclungtransplant.org. Generally, we think about hackers as being people who know how to wreak havoc on computers and computer networks, but really not all hackers are bad, and actually the technical definition of hacker is someone into technological tinkering and innovation. happening here in Charlotte. Some of these hackers are poised to help computer novices become more comfortable in the digital world. We'll find out all about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Senate Homeland Security Committee hears testimony on the economic benefits of Bitcoin. Critics argue it provides a safe haven for drug traffickers and other criminals. Debate over the growing use of the digital currency.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the relevance of museums today, how they make themselves more attractive to new generations and make themselves inviting and a memorable experience to which people will want to return. And we're doing that with Terry Davis, who's the president of the American Association for State and Local History, who joins us by phone from Nashville, Tennessee. She helps museums around the country, history museums around the country, do what we're talking about. Emily Zimmern is president and CEO of the Levine Museum of the New South. Christopher Long, vice president of programming for the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. And Kay Penninger is executive director of the Charlotte Museum of History, who's trying frantically to get into this conversation before the break. Go ahead, Kay, you're on.
I think one of the ways that a museum or a historic site or an art museum can make itself relevant, keep itself relevant, is to continually adapt to society. So as society changes and becomes more complex, the stories that we tell need to reflect that. So instead, and using your example of George Washington and Mount Vernon, so Mount Vernon has changed its story from being just George Washington slept here, mm-hmm. To, you know, what was George Washington like as a person? George Washington the farmer, George Washington the political leader, who else was present at Mount Vernon? There was the enslaved population. What did the women do here? What did the children do? How were they educated? What kind of games did they play? And that helps us identify with them so that, you know, I can go and relate to the stories of Martha Washington or the enslaved women who were cooking and butchering and preparing meals. Or my kids can go and they can relate to the education that the children went through. History is so fascinating and it's very complex. But we don't teach it like that. We teach it as a timeline of dates to be remembered.
Yes, it's dry and it's dusty and it's disinteresting to many young people. And I would think that if you do it right, it becomes alive. And when it's alive, it becomes relevant and relatable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Precisely, Levine Museum took a group of young teenagers from here in Charlotte on History Active, bus tour of civil rights sites around the South. And for them, it was very much about relating the issues from 50 years ago to issues they confront every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say, Mike, history museums and museums in general, as they reinvent themselves, are using the virtual space to extend their reach. I mean, the blogs, not just the digitization of collections, because the millennials who are the digital natives, we have to engage them digitally. And I think museums are doing that. But in addition, I think that museums are extending their reach beyond their four walls. There are many examples of programming out where communities actually live, or having pop-up exhibits or programming in the community. Mm-hmm. So how museums create value is being reinvented.
Although Mark on Twitter, using digital technology to reach us today, says looking at museum pieces online is like watching the Nutcracker on YouTube.
I couldn't agree more.
Me too.
I couldn't agree more. That's not what we're talking about, but providing lesson plans for teachers online. Mm-hmm. Or we've had actually young people creating a blog online where they have, when we had the old pictures outside our museum, they took them down and asked questions, and they got responses from all over the world. People from Australia and from Europe were commenting on these images that the young people were asking questions about, college students.
Mm-hmm. I think of digital media and YouTube is used properly, it's the slightly, you know, turning of the knob, opening the door to have people experience the Nutcracker or art or some musical piece for them to then go out to their community to become an active participant for it. It's a way to just introduce them.
One of the programs that we're developing for the spring is currently we have an exhibit up called Charlotte Neighborhoods, and we're looking at going out into the community, doing some walking tours of the neighborhoods that we're discussing. But History Pin is a website where you could take a modern landscape and pin a building, an old picture of a building, to where it used to be, so that you can. It's a great way to use technology to show what this streetscape may have looked like mm-hmm. back in the 1800s, and then what it's like today. Mm-hmm. And that really helps people visualize it.
You took over the Charlotte Museum of History when it was facing some serious financial shortfalls. And I think even the museum had pretty much shut itself down, and you took the job and came. What have you been able to do to reverse their fortunes?
Well, I took over after the museum, all that hard work of taking it down and shuttering it had already been done. So I came in when we were bringing it back to life. Mm-hmm. So what I have done is pretty much go back to fundamentals and building a strong foundation, making sure that we are operating in a fiscally responsible manner. We have a balanced budget. We have the board has adopted best practice financial procedures. We're working with our auditors closely to make sure they're happy with everything we're doing. Also, I think one of the core values of a museum is education. I love education. So I'm looking at our educational programming and making sure that it's relevant. And so if a school system is coming to us for tours, which we are again doing the tours for Charlotte-Mecklenburg system, I want to make sure that it's a valuable experience for those teachers and students. I don't want the teachers to have to go back and undo what we've done but at their visit. So I'm making sure that our content is aligned to the North Carolina standards and their essential standards, and so that we want to the teachers talking and teaching in the classroom, and they come to see us, and we bring it to life.
I would think it's very difficult to be creative and to find new ways to be relevant and to find new ways to bring people into the museum and give them an even better experience than they had 10 years ago when they came into a museum, whether it's your museum or another. At the same time that funding has been so drastically reduced, and it has been drastically reduced because of the economy, and because although our Arts and Science Council fund drive used to be one of the top fund drives in the country, it is no more. How has that impacted the three museums represented by the people sitting around this table? The Beckler seems to be a different case than the other, but I could be wrong about that.
It is slightly different. We opened in January of 2010, so we're just getting ready to celebrate our fourth year in operation. And when the financial world turned upside down, there was nothing but a big hole in the ground where the Beckler now stands. So we started out with this idea of maybe not having the same resources that other organizations have had in the past. We started out with a very lean staff that we still continue to this day. We still operate completely in the black, and we have reserves, and we make sure that we don't have lines of credit. I mean, we make sure that
it's part of that because your collection was donated by the man whose name is on the building.
Meaning what? Meaning
you didn't have to acquire it.
No, we did not have to acquire it. The 1,500 pieces that we have, you know, certainly was donated by Andreas Beckler. But the museum operation itself, it's not just the art. It is also our $2.5 million budget that, you know, we have to have every year in order to have this facility to operate and for people to see the art that we have. So we're very responsible in how we operate the museum.
Levine Museum has been incredibly fortunate, even in the darkest days, because collaboration was one of our core values. Everything that the museum has done programmatically over the years has really been co-created and co-delivered with community partners. So when the economic struggles arrived, fortunately, we were able to work with community partners who worked with us, and we were able to continue programming. UNC Charlotte stepped up as education sponsor for our Changing Places exhibit. And every month for a year held incredible programs, Changing Times, Changing Minds, about how our community was responding to the changes, especially demographically and economically. And then we partner with the Latin American Chamber of Commerce every year for Day of the Dead. So leveraging the partnerships and working together, we could do more collectively than either of us can do individually. And I think that's a sign of the times.
You want to jump in here, Kay?
Well, I would just like to say that I'm very grateful to the Arts and Science Council and to the Foundation for the Carolinas for the support and guidance that they gave to the Charlotte Museum of History when it was going through its troubled times. They really, I think, were very instrumental in keeping the museum viable.
Emily brought up the word demographics. It's a word that I would never have thought of in association with museums, but until yesterday when I was reading through all this material and trying to figure out what we were going to talk about. But the demographics of the country are changing quickly and irrevocably, and particularly here in the American South. And that seems to me, Terry, to impact history museums, because American history has traditionally been white European history. What are you telling museums around the country in ways about how to become relevant to our increasingly diverse population?
Well, certainly they have to be all-inclusive of the audiences that are in their communities, and that's not just a community of where they live, but any community, including the community of social media and so on and so forth. People want to see a part of themselves when they visit a museum. They want to be able to relate to what they see and say, gosh, I believe my grandmother, my great-grandmother used to do that, and to have some conversation that they can take home. That's one of the beauties of history is you can take a conversation home to the dinner table and continue the conversation within the family. There was a study done several years ago about the most trusted, who's the most trusted, who do you get the history from and you trust the answers the most. And above education or museums or any other place, first of all, was the grandparents or the parents, and second of all was museums that came above education. But, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that you think that all museums are history, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think that one of the saddest things that's happened in the past decade or so is there's been a kind of devaluation of history in American public policy. You know, history really starts in the schools and how it's taught, and teaching about dead white males and timelines gave no interest to children in the past. And one of the things that happened in museums a couple decades ago was history made a change from being about the collections to being about the stories. And that really opened the door to relevancy, and it opened the door to the changing demographics that we're talking about, because we could talk about stories and relate more to whatever communities we're trying to relate to. There's just a huge lack of funding for history all over in all segments of history.
Yeah, I want to come back to that with you, because I want to talk about your opinions about the devaluation of history in a second. But first, let me go over here to Emily.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everyone's history matters. In that, this whole issue of demographic transformation is one that all kinds of museums have to wrestle with, not simply history museums. The Center for the Future of Museums conducted a study several years ago and found that only 1 in 10 of core museum visitors, all kinds of museums, are people of color. And giving demographic trends, museums have to do a better job of reaching out and engaging the changing face of America.
You have to show them.
Yes. And Levine has really been very active in that area. We applied for and received one of the inaugural National Innovation lab grants to study how museums could be more engaging to diverse audiences. And we created the Latino New South Project and worked with the Atlanta History Center and the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and held listening sessions in our three communities to really engage Latino communities, not just to hear what's on their mind, but also to figure out how can museums serve them and create meaningful, sustainable relationships.
Is this a particular challenge for the Beckler, because that collection comes from Western Europe?
When you're talking about modern art of European descent, you're talking about dead white guys, as you pointed out. I want to go back to a comment that you had about show them them. Mm-hmm. You have to show them them. I agree with that. But you also have to relate stories for across all different types of peoples. And we use the Beckler story quite frequently in all of our education materials and in our mission, so that people can relate to this family of collectors. Mm-hmm. We also use stories about the artists. We also use stories about history and what happened during this time, post-World War II, and degenerate artists and whatnot, to see the disenfranchisement that these artists had to go through during the Nazi regime. But we also take programming to them. We don't expect the audience just to come to us. We take programming to them.
And you've taken it outside the museum. You had that Nikki de Saint-Phal collection of gigantic sculptures,
yes,
across the street from the museum, and, of course, the Firebird, which has become – for years we talked about needing a symbol for the city of Charlotte. People even suggested putting up a space needle like Seattle. I think we found it. I think the Firebird is it.
It's a new visual symbol, absolutely. I was watching the game last night, and ESPN – four or five times showed the Firebird when they were, as they were broadcasting the game. I've seen the Firebird all over when the DNC was here, mm-hmm, even on an episode of The Real Housewives of Atlanta. I mean, it's it's the visual symbol of Charlotte.
Yep, I think that's it. And people, everybody who comes downtown wants to have their picture taken in front of it, around it, behind it, underneath it.
My office window overlooks the Firebird, and I look out the window, several times a day, and there's always somebody there.
So does that bring people in, the fact that that enormous mirrored creation is sitting out in front of that museum, does that intrigue people enough to draw them through the doors?
Oh, absolutely. It's a piece from the museum's collection that is outside the doors that can seem big and ominous and uninviting to some people. But when you can experience it and go up to it, in this case, you can actually touch this piece of art, you wonder more about what is behind the doors of the museum.
What kinds of programming seem to work best in Charlotte to increase people coming to your museum? Because we talk about things at the Levine and the Charlotte Museum of History and the Beckler all the time on this program, and sometimes they're discussion series, sometimes they're new exhibits, sometimes they're traveling exhibits, sometimes it's something, some enhancement to the permanent collection. What seems to intrigue people where you see a rise in attendance?
I think some of the things that appeal are something that's going to, in multiple aspects, something that might include history, music, food, something that appeals to everybody in your family. So it's not that you have one person who wants to go and a couple of people who are rolling their eyes going, please don't make me go there.
Mm-hmm. Well, here at Levine Museum, of course, what we have become known for is tackling tough issues that address community challenges.
Right.
Whether it was courage and the issue of school desegregation and educational equity, or changing places, the changing demography. So I think that when people see that we are addressing relevant topics, they want to learn more.
And I know the Beckler has used jazz concerts to bring people very successfully through the door. We'll talk about that and about history again with Terry Davis in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lenore Ryan University graduate programs, offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. The Senate Homeland Security Committee hears testimony on the economic benefits of Bitcoin Critics argue that it provides a safe haven for drug traffickers and other criminals. And Diane Rehm and her guests will discuss new questions about this digital currency known as Bitcoin coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about museums, the future of museums, the relevance of museums, and how to make them more so in the digital age. And if you have some comments, suggestions, or questions, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great way to get through to our panelists, and we are coming right back.
My Car Dave was in the shop over 40 times in 8 months. Hi, I'm Paula Poundstone from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So one time, I slammed the door, and as I do so, the back of the front seat just fell off. I had never realized how important the back of the front seat is until the following day when I was driving up a hill and began to slide into the back seat. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of museums and how they remain relevant with Kay Penninger, who's the executive director of the Charlotte Museum of History, which has the word history in its name. I want to talk about that. Christopher Lying, vice president of programming for the Beckner Museum of Modern Art. Emily Zimmern, president and CEO of the Levine Museum of the New South. And Terry Davis, who's the president of the American Association for State and Local History. They work with history museums around the country. You use music to bring people into the museum. You very successfully have used jazz programming to bring people into the Beckler. How does that fit into your mission as an art museum?
Going back to what we were talking about earlier, the idea that it's not just a one-pronged approach to bring people into the museum, it's multiple ways, and we use different types of mediums to bring people in to understand and enjoy the modern art. Abstract art can be a little bit off-putting. There's too much ambiguity into it. So what's the vehicle that can bring people into the museum to understand more about it? Music is an excellent way to do that. Jazz, late 50s, Paris scene, and, you know, it is the sweet spot for jazz and for our collection. We started out with a jazz series almost 4 years ago. That's 60 people on our first night. Now we have two shows and 600 people come. We have chamber music, sometimes four times a month. That's an art and music fusion discussion between works and of art and works by composers, because these things didn't happen in bubbles that were not connected. They were all interconnected. We tend to not think of these things. We have, you know, smaller lecture series. We have a film series devoted to architecture and to modernism. And we try to find ways to entice people through something they can understand and talk about things that they may not be able to understand.
We live in a city that is, if you don't scratch the surface, devoid of history, at least visually, because everything down, we're sitting in a downtown area that's sparkling and new and looks like it was built yesterday. It's gorgeous, but it was built yesterday. And I know that Dan Morrill will tell me I'm completely wrong, because he's told me I'm completely wrong about that, that there's history everywhere, but you have to look for it. And you have the word history in the name of your museum. And there are people who come here from elsewhere who want to know, it seems to me, about where they've moved. Does the fact that you have history in your name help you?
I think the word history helps us. I think the word museum hurts us.
So how do you make them work together there?
I think people interpret the word museum as kind of dull, boring, something that my grandmother did. So we have to really some creative ways that we've tried to – I love connecting the past with the present. We just had a backcountry beer fest. Beer was the safest thing to drink in colonial times because it was boiled instead of just drinking the water straight out of the spring. So craft beer is very popular right now, and Charlotte has a great beer scene. So we had some of the brew made from the original brewmasters. Got some water out of the spring.
You can taste what they were tasting.
you can sort of approximate it. We use a colonial recipe. We use water from the spring at the house, boiled it, let it sit on the property like it would have back in the 1700s. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Likewise, one of Levine Museum's most popular programs is the New South for New Southerners.
Right.
And newcomers and natives alike come and explore history in a lighthearted way, have a great dinner from Mertz Heart and Soul, and then talk about a variety of topics. And one of the most popular is just ask the historians, and people ask, you know, who's Sharon?
Yeah.
I mean, et cetera, et cetera. And people have a great time. You know, half the people didn't live here 25 years ago.
Right.
And so they do want to learn about this place they call home.
Right. It gives you context for where you live. Terry, you have said that the devaluation of history in American culture and our schools is a major problem that must be addressed. Let's
Absolutely.
Talk about it. How has history been devalued?
Well, certainly there are many examples, including the No Child Left Behind Act, that focused more on science and technology and did not recognize history as one of the core educational values. Money has been taken away from the states and local governments. Anytime money gets tight, it's arts and culture that suffers the most, I'm afraid. And within the national public policy, it seems as though the government is more interested in what they call STEM education and STEM funding, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, than in the humanities in general and history in particular. There's lots of funding for STEM projects around the country. There's the National Science Foundation that I don't know what they're giving this year, but has given as much as $60 million to science museums. Plus, there are corporations that do that. In art, my colleague might disagree with this, but in art, there are at least two places where funding comes from, and one is the National Endowment for the Arts that gives money to the states to give out, and the second is that there are benefactors for art museums that history museums simply don't enjoy. We have very few benefactors and very few foundations that focus in on history. They focus in mostly on art because of the money that's involved from the benefactors.
Yeah, you told one of our producers that the Institute of Museum and Library Services provides a mere $31 million a year to all of America's museums, including zoos, while history museums are left to swing in the wind. And you talked about STEM education in schools in Charlotte and probably other places around the country. They've added an A to that, STEAM education. Mm-hmm. So it's science, technology, arts, engineering, and math. But who stands up for history? Who stands up for our heritage? Who are we if we don't know where we came from?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a very big problem, I believe. And the only federal agency that has the word museum in it is the Institute of Museum and Library Services. And $31 million funds very few projects, as you can imagine.
So that's an argument for the relevancy of museums. But how do you convince museum goers that they need this relevance, that you are relevant to their lives, that if they will come through the doors, their lives will be enhanced?
Yes, and that is the challenge that museums are facing today. If you walk up to the man on the street and say, do you believe history is a value, they're going to say yes. They don't want to be the person that says no, but they're going to say yes because they believe it. If you say to them, how can you help support history because it's being devalued by public policy, they don't have a clue. And I think it is up to history museums, which are, I agree with my colleague about the word museums. History Center is being used a lot. A lot of places are changing their names to history centers. But it's up to the history center or history museum or history organization that doesn't collect at all to get out into the community and really do the partnerships that was talked about and show the value that they have. You know, I can't imagine what science would be like, for example, if you were to mix good science with bad ethics or bad decisions that were made in the past. You have to know what happened and the consequences of what happened in order to make good decisions for the future. And certainly history brings good critical thinking skills to the people that experience it through good programming. And between that and going out into the community and making the institution relevant, whether we're talking about city planning or going into the cultural centers, as one of your guests alluded, those types of things are really going a long way to help us be relevant. But one of the things that we don't have that a lot of other museums do have is great data on how this all happens and how much it happens. And we don't have the data because history institutions are, they're as small as the all-volunteer historic house and as large as Colonial Williamsburg, and we've not been able to even get a really good census on museums. The Institute of Museum and Library Services cannot tell you how many museums there are in America.
Wow. Of course, gathering data takes money, or the NSA, money is in short supply. Emily, you wanted to jump in.
Well, I would say, you know, Levine Museum is only 22 years old, and so since the very beginning, we have wrestled with how do you make history relevant in a city of newcomers. And a major way is going out and really listening to people, talking to people. What is it you want to know? What is it you want to learn? What are the stories you want told in the museum? I mean, the good fortune for Levine Museum in the New South is we tell the stories both of those who have shaped our region's history and those who are continuously reinventing the South today. Because it's critically important that all the newcomers are bringing their history and their culture, and we all need to understand one another, and that cross-cultural understanding is a 21st century skill that is vitally needed in this global economy.
Go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, our history is a continuum of decisions and events that were made. So we are always affected by these decisions that were made in the past. And we are, the children of the future are going to be affected by the decisions that we're making here and now. So it's really important to understand how we got to where we are today so that we can try to do better in the future.
And Tom Hanchett, our historian, works with the Community Building Initiative, and they do bus tours called Black, White, and More, which looks at the West Side Corridor and issues of black and white, and then go over to the East Side and look at the much more diverse area with immigrants and newcomers. And the point is precisely that. The decisions that were made a long time ago shape exactly who we are. And the decisions we're making today are going to shape our future. And as Kay said, that's absolutely a continuum. And it's critically important to understand that. That's not abstract. That's not dusty. That's our lived lives every day.
It's reality.
And the quality of the community. I mean, what kind of community are we going to be?
And when the Beckler started almost 4 years ago, we took the idea of what our community wanted to see in the newest museum. So we polled all of our audience members for the first couple of years to see what it is they wanted us to do related to this wonderful gift that Andreas Beckler gave to the city of Charlotte. And the predominant answer was this idea of outreach, this idea of access and inclusion, this idea of bringing new audiences into the museum, or to bring art to those that they perceive to be, you know, more disenfranchised.
And Terry, that's what I'm understanding, what I read yesterday about a lot of museums around the country are doing. They're doing a lot of listening to the people in the community, the people who come through their doors, the people who don't come through their doors. How do you listen to those people?
Well, research and visitor studies is a really big deal in history organizations right now. Many of them can't afford really deep research, but certainly even the simplest of asking your guests what was the best experience, what did you absorb the most, what type of interpretation do you think will stick with you, and those types of things are the easiest. How to figure out who's not coming through the door is the really, really hard part. But I think that visitor studies and doing evaluations of your programs is an acceptable and necessary best practice now that certainly wasn't a couple of decades ago.
Let me I'm sorry. Let me share a couple of things that have come in on emails and Facebook and Twitter as we've gone through this discussion. Melba emails, there's no comparison. And I'm not sure what she's talking about here, but maybe we'll get into it in the body of this. I had read and heard a lot about, it's about going to museums and seeing things as opposed to seeing them online. I had read and heard a lot about Mandela's imprisonment on Robben Island in South Africa for years, but nothing captured the experience of actually going there and seeing and experiencing it for myself. I was surprised by the emotion it brought out. In fact, I was crying so loudly I almost drowned out the former prisoner leading the tour. Patrick on Facebook about stumbling on something at a museum that creates a new passion. I was never a big fan, he says, of Botticelli, until I saw the Botticelli room at the Uffizi in Florence. The Birth of Venus and Primavera are astonishing in both their scale and technique. It's something I hope everyone gets to experience. And I'm sure you have people tell you that when they go through the Beckler and see some of these gigantic works or some of the, even the small works, the little statues, the little the gold coins and things that you have. Della emails, I've traveled all over and visited many museums, but my favorite is the Metropolitan in New York. Always wanted to go there to see my favorite painting by Goya, Don Manuel Osorio. I can stare at a painting for a long time because it sucks me into the history of other people who have done the same thing from the time it was painted until the present day. I grew up, as I said, in Washington, where the Smithsonian is free. And it shocked me the first time I went to a museum outside of Washington that I had to pay to get in. I thought, you don't pay to go to a museum. And I read yesterday that the Dallas Museum of Art in Texas has abolished fees for admission and for basic membership because they believe that participation drives philanthropy and they need the money. They need the philanthropy. What's your take on that?
That is a new approach to fundraising for museums, that they are seeking corporate underwriting in order to bring in more of the public. So they will go to a funder and say, you know, if you provide, you know, the same amount of support that we would have generated through the earned income from admissions, then they can make it free and available to everybody and engage more people.
And go ahead. And I'm fairly familiar with this model and this museum and the idea that there's an altruistic nature in our society, that if I give something, others can come for free to experience it.
Right.
The museum is free every Sunday afternoon.
Also discovered that boomers, baby boomers, have not been great philanthropists, but the millennials are, but they want to know precisely what their money is going for. Kay Penninger, Christopher Long, Emily Zimmern, Terry Davis, thank you all for the hour.